If you've traveled outside your own country, you'll know that there's a period of time when you first arrive in a new place where it seems as if you see everything very clearly. I think it's because we haven't laid over the landscape our own personal stories yet. And that's how it was for me the first time that I arrived in Chicago on my way to theological school. For about 3 days, I felt like I saw everything the way it truly was. Driving into Chicago from the O'Hare Airport that first year, among many things, what I saw was color, race, layers of race and color. It seemed that there were stronger blacks, warmer browns, paler whites than what I was used to. And I saw class, layers of class. And I saw how color and class fit together, almost stacked up as if they were ancient rock formations. The struggles to heal class and race divides the United States in a huge way. And our denomination has been energetically addressing racism and systemic racism within the association since we, and I mean both countries, both the United States and Canada, awoke. Not that some people were not already awake, but in the huge population of both countries, awoke to the racial injustice and economic disparities that were brought to the forefront by Martin Luther King. And in particular, the killing of the Unitarian minister, the white Unitarian minister, James Reeb. And that was during the civil rights struggle in Alabama in 1965. My experience at Meadville, the Unitarian Theological School in Chicago, began with a 3-day conference on race. And as I listened to speaker after speaker recount their personal stories of abuse, inequity, and injustice, my little internal Canadian voice kept going, but, that's not the way it is in Vancouver. That's not true for Canada. In Vancouver, we don't have a race problem like that. We're a multicultural city. We get along peacefully. But my voice was definitely out of sync with the American experience. I was really at that time quite naive and uneducated regarding race and the American history. And I have to admit, I was also, in some degree, ignorant, uneducated about race and Canadian history. When did you first notice the color of your skin? And what was your first memory of your race? Let me just say here before we go farther that we all know that race is a cultural construct and that it has no basis, no reality genetically, or very, very tiny. But we continue to be influenced by race, and that being the color of our skins. Well, my first experiences of race were in my family home. We had 2 rooms in the basement that were filled every year by international students. We live very close to the University of British Columbia. And every year there were different students in the basement, and their skin colors ranged from deep, deep black to warm, pale ashes. And they came from around the world, from Africa to China and many places between. Some of the men, there was always men, no women. Some of the men were warm and outgoing, and others were cool and distant. In my memory, they never shared meals with us. The only time I ever saw them was when they would come upstairs to hand in their monthly rent check. And so I created in my unconsciousness a sense that there was a separation between these men from around the world that were living in the basement and what my family did upstairs. We didn't invite them in for dinner. They didn't share holidays with us. It was sort of an upstairs-downstairs story. In other words, it was a layering. When my family moved to Montreal, I was 13, and I began a friendship with a girl my own age whose skin was black. This was my first interracial relationship. One day I went over to her house to hang out. We were sitting around the living room, and I remember peering very closely at her skin, fascinated by how different it was to mine. Her mother must have seen me doing this, and she got very angry and told me to stop it. I felt ashamed, and I didn't understand why. The relationship with the friend petered out, tainted as it was now with my own confused feelings of shame and something that was beyond my experience and understanding. Shame has this effect. Shame withers those connections around us. Like a diseased limb of a tree, shame wilts that outreached arm, and relationships tend to slip away. Now, at the time, I didn't know about the mother's background. Today, I can only imagine the racism that she had endured in her lifetime, the bigotry, the hatred that she possibly had lived through and wanted to protect her daughter from. It was 1970. That was only 5 years after the civil rights movement hit its peak in the United States. And even, hear that word, even in Montreal, racism was fully alive. That same year, 1970, 400 students took over the computer lab of Sir George William University. The occupation was sparked by the university's mishandling of racism allegations against one of its white professors. Leading up to that takeover, the same university had hosted, they had just hosted a conference to examine, quote, the problems in the Canadian society with reference to black people, unquote. And in Ontario, the Ku Klux Klan had recently defaced the Black Baptist Church. These were incidents at the time that I, as a 13-year-old, were completely unaware of. Now, today we talk about teaching moments, you know, those unique opportunities when people are really open and ready to learn. Well, that moment might have been one of those teaching moments if I hadn't felt so paralyzed by my shame, and the mother hadn't been so angry, maybe I might have said, why? Why are you so angry? What does it mean? Help me understand. And maybe she might have told me, and maybe I might have understood. I was brought up to not talk about race. No one ever told me that it was impolite to talk about race, not directly. I just sensed it. If in my family or in my friends we ever talked about race, it was in a very academic, objective, something about somebody else, not about us. It wasn't personal. It wasn't about the feelings that were there. And I've concluded that we weren't supposed to have any feelings at all about race or about being white. Over time, I, like many of us, internalized that cultural story that told me it was impolite to talk about race because we don't do that. So who is the we? And why is it impolite? And where does that come from? What I've learned through my education in Chicago and my friends and professors there is that in the Black and Hispanic community in the States, people talk about race all the time. It's a necessity. It is survival. It's reality. But white people don't. So now I challenge my cultural upbringing and say, it's not about being impolite. It's because talking about race makes white people, my people, me, feel uncomfortable. Now let me be even more specific. Talking about race is uncomfortable. Talking about being white is uncomfortable. Vendeka, Emmy Award-winning television producer, journalist, talk show host, and Unitarian Universalist theologian, wrote a book in 2007 called Learning to Be White, Money, Race, and God in America. It was based on many conversations with white people. She developed a theory that white identity is created from shame and that it is mostly unconscious shame that fuels racial separation. It began when a white colleague openly, warmly, and perhaps naively asked her, "What's it like to be black?" And she responded that she couldn't answer that question right away in a way that would be useful and understandable to her colleague until the colleague became conscious of her own racialization process. In other words, how the colleague had become white. So Vendeka invented something called, or what she called, the race game. And she invited this colleague to play it for a week. Now, there's only one rule to the race game, and that is when you are talking about people that you know, and if they have a Caucasian background history, you use the descriptor white. My white friend, my white child, my white grocery store person. Vendeka wanted her colleague to bring forward the unvoiced racial language of being a Euro-American. Unvoiced is really important. The colleague, guess what?
Was offended.
No, she wasn't offended, but they never had lunch together again.
She was offended.
Or she was scared. So Vendeka tried this game with many, many people over the course of years. And even the seemingly most enthusiastic people had a very hard time sticking with it. I tried it myself and found it brought up all kinds of feelings of uncomfortableness and self-consciousness, as if I was exposing something that wasn't meant to be exposed, something unseemly, something that wasn't meant to be talked about, which is Vendeka's point. She suspected that there were feelings that lay below the word white that were too potent to be faced. Through hundreds of conversations, she began to see the shame that was attached to the racialization of whiteness. She tells the story of Dorothy, who was taken to live in Mexico with her family when she was 5 years old. Dorothy was white, and she was not allowed to play with the Mexican brown-skinned children. And she yearned to play with them. They looked like they were having so much fun. In her imagination, although too young to really understand the she was too young to understand the concept of race and segregation. In her young mind, she imagined herself becoming brown. And if she was brown, then she could play with these other children. You know, as an adult, she was not even aware that this had happened. She had no memory of it until she started talking with Andeka about where does whiteness come from? And it had affected her whole life. She said to Thandeka, "You know, you are the first black woman that I've been comfortable to talk about racism with." And Thandeka replied, "Why is it so easy for you to think of me as black? And yet just a few minutes ago, you could not make any sense out of thinking of yourself as white. Are we really talking about racism? And whose? Your parents? Yours? The little 5-year-old girls?" And so Dorothy began to realize that at 5 years old, she'd been so enraged with her own whiteness because it prevented her from playing with her friends or the friends she wanted to have. So enraged with her own whiteness and with no knowledge of the power to choose, she'd been forced to become part of a white group, a whiteness race, which set itself above and separate from those brown-skinned children that she was not allowed to play with. And so, conflicted by this experience, Dorothy buried it very deep in her psyche. And since that time, Dorothy had learned to think of others and herself in racial terms. White or brown, us or them. So Thandeka began to believe, or she came to believe, that the Euro-American child, quote, is a racial victim of its own white community of parents, caretakers, and peers who attack it because it does not yet have a white identity. Rather than continue to suffer such attacks, the Euro child defends itself by creating a white racial identity for itself. It begins to think and act like its community's ideal of a white self. End of quote. Now, I can see how this would be, and I'm sure you can too, right? Every family has its do's and don'ts. Each community upholds its cultural points of view, its racial perspectives, values, and principles. And most of us will adapt to the community that we're in, especially when we're younger and dependent on those around us for our care and our love. Part of growing up and maturing is something called differentiation, or in layman's terms, rebellion, what most teenagers need to go through, in order to find themselves as separate and distinct from their parents and possibly their culture. Rebellion can help us see the world differently and give us space and perspective to make new choices about who we are and how we fit in or not fit in to our family or racial cultural context. But sometimes, rebellion's not enough. Sometimes we don't know how to rebel. Sometimes we can't rebel. And sometimes we need help from somebody else. In the experience with my 13-year-old friend and her mother, my shame was connected to those conflicting feelings that I had done something terribly wrong. I'd broken some rule. That my whiteness represented something bad. And so I, too, internalized that message that I must not venture into dangerous areas that I didn't understand, areas of race. 3 years ago, I took a class on African American history and the Unitarian Universalist movement from an amazing professor, author, and minister, Mark Morrison Reed. Mark is black. He grew up in Chicago at the First Unitarian Church there in Chicago. And when he rebelled, he went off to Switzerland to sort out what he was and race was and America was. Mark's gift is his huge, compassionate heart that invites everyone to safely touch those places inside that are conflicted and stuck in shame. You know, I was shocked to discover that I held inside me thoughts of racial judgment, thoughts of separation and otherness that were the opposite of my ideals and principles and beliefs. It was as if my heart had been broken and I didn't even know it. The shame that came was sudden and shocking. But because of Mark's deep and open compassion that permeated that classroom, I walked toward it, felt it, and I didn't wither and retract from it. Rather, I used my own compassion to forgive myself, and in forgiving, released and let go of that shame. I became a Unitarian because I identified with the principles at the front of our hymnal. My heart and soul, I know, deep in my heart and soul, I know that every person has inherent worth and dignity. I know in my heart and soul that the universe created life in a plethora of magnificent diversity. And I know in my heart and my soul that our diversity is an expression of one all-encompassing life force. I know that we are all one. And it hurts like hell to realize that my cultural upbringing instilled in me that shame of otherness, that lie of superiority, the separation between myself and another human being whose skin or position or age is different from mine. It is not impolite to talk about race. But for white folk, and I'm talking to the white folk in this room right now, we have got to talk about what becoming white has done to our hearts, how it's divided their heart. And if we find that we have incorporated any trace of separatism, if we find that we are afraid to talk about it, then I suspect at the root of that fear, you will find a kernel of shame. And if we find it, then our job is to gently, courageously, and compassionately look at it, feel it, and forgive ourselves. We do not need any more shame in our lives, and we certainly don't need any more walls between us and other people. I hope nobody told you that living from our principles was going to be a piece of cake. Because this work, to remove our cultural fears, our internalized shame, it takes some courage. But believe me, it is so worth it. Our hearts, our world, depend upon it. May we each have the courage to seek wholeness. That we may live into our principles of worth and dignity of every person. Every person. Including ourselves. So be it. And amen.